underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Jay McInerney became famous in the 1980s for Bright Lights, Big City, a semi-autobiographical novel about a young man coming of age in Manhattan. But his latest book is more domestic in nature, focusing on the idea of a perfect marriage. Also set in New York City, Bright Precious Days is the third book in a trilogy about married couple Russell and Corrine Calloway. During the course of their marriage, the Calloways face crises and infidelity, but somehow manage to stick together. But as this novel unfolds across a period of great change, the Calloways find themselves and their marriage tested more severely than they could have imagined. Jay McInerney is the author of seven previous novels, a collection of short stories, three collections of essays on wine. Again, his latest novel is Bright Precious Days, and we welcome Jay McInerney to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to be here.
Before we get into the subject within this particular novel, what was it about this couple that you wanted to explore over a series of three books?
Well, when I started out, I had no idea that I was embarking on a trilogy. I first introduced these characters in a short story called Smoke, which was the first thing I wrote after Bright Lights, Big City. And a few years later, I was standing on the corner of Fifth Avenue waiting to cross. I was on Fifth Avenue waiting to cross the street, and I looked over and saw a homeless man standing next to Ronald Perlman, the billionaire. And it was a very striking image, obviously. And I thought to myself, you know, this is New York. I want to write a book that has the billionaire and the homeless guy in it. And, you know, I was reading Balzac at the time and Thackeray. So I was sort of dreaming of widening the scope of my, you know, my previous New York books were kind of told from a single point of view and were somewhat limited in scope. And so I conceived this panoramic sort of social novel, but I felt like I needed, you know, kind of a every man and woman to hold it together in the middle. And I thought of Russell and Corrine, these characters that I'd written a short story about. You know, at the time I knew two, three couples in the city. I was in my late 20s, early 30s then, that seemed to embody the idea of, you know, the perfect couple. They were good-looking, bright. They threw cocktail parties. They seemed to have it all together. And I think we all know people like that. And I said, and of course there is no such thing as a perfect couple, but I thought it was an interesting idea to start with. And so Russell and Corrine first came into prominence with it as the focus of this novel, Brightness Falls, which was set in the late 1980s and kind of culminates with the stock market crash of 87. And they stuck with me. I had not thought I would write about them again, but in the days after September 11th, when I was trying to come to terms with how to possibly write about that crisis, I thought, you know, I should revisit them and write about how it affected their lives and the lives of their friends and social circle. So hence a second novel. And at that point, I thought I would probably keep going.
So at the beginning of this novel, you write about how this couple came to New York City. So give us a sense of what brings these two people to the city in the first place.
Well, I think, you know, I think like so many of us, like millions of us, in fact, they're attracted by the notion that Manhattan is somehow the center of the world, that it's the place where the brightest, most ambitious, questing people flock to. And in Russell's case, he's he wants to be at the center of the literary world. He is a former writer who has decided that his talents would better be used, perhaps as an editor, as a sort of midwife to literature. And you know, Manhattan is pretty much the place to go if you want to be an editor. Corrine's ambitions are a little more diffuse at first, but she, when we first meet her, is working as a stockbroker on Wall Street in the middle of one of the great financial booms, the mid-80s financial boom. And they meet each other at Brown University, and they're drawn to New York, as most of my characters are, like moths to a flame.
Is that similar to your experience of what drew you to the city?
Yeah, I just felt like it was the place to be. I actually had a little detour after college. I tried to get a job at the New York Times and the New York Daily News and Advertising Age and so on. But when I graduated from college, Woodward and Bernstein had made journalism the most popular career in America. And let's face it, there aren't that many jobs. Even then, there weren't that many jobs in journalism. So I took a detour to Japan, where I got a fellowship from Princeton, and I taught English. And yet, I kept hearing about what was happening in New York. For one thing, my college roommate, Gary Fiskejohn, was there working for Random House. And there was also, you know, there was this incredible music coming out of the Lower East Side, you know, the Talking Heads and the Ramones and Television and Blondie. And you know, there was also this resurgent art scene, painters like Schnabel and Fischl and David Sally were kind of reinventing painting. And so it was a combination of that sort of downtown energy that I was hearing all the way or feeling all the way in Japan. And also the notion that as a writer, you know, New York was the place to go. It was where the New Yorker was and the Paris Review was and all the publishing houses. And so I returned to America and to New York in the fall of 1979, which was an interesting time to arrive.
You got a job at the New Yorker.
First, I had a job at Random House reading slush, as we called it, which was unsolicited manuscripts. And then eventually I landed at the New Yorker as a fact checker.
Which you were fired from that job.
Yes, I was. It's amusing now. It was not amusing at the time. I was kind of mortified because I felt that I had arrived at sort of, you know, the center of things, the red hot center. Mm. It was the New Yorker, and it was, you know, J.D. Salinger was still calling William Shawn on the phone down the hallway from me, and you know, John Updike was seen walking the halls, and John Cheever, and it was kind of a dream come true. On the one hand, on the other hand, I had really no interest in fact checking, and I think that I demonstrated that by failing to be very good at it, and. I was fired for an article that had not a lot of mistakes, but any mistakes are too many for the New Yorker. And it was an article about the French elections, and I had sort of bumbled my way through various telephone conversations in French, having claimed on my resume that I was fluent, which I wasn't.
It's significant because, look, we all get fired from jobs, but it's significant because really the rule of thumb is nobody gets fired from the New Yorker.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Ivy League. You know, once you're in, it's pretty hard to get kicked out, but I managed it. Yeah, the legend was that I was the first person fired from the New Yorker in its long, I don't know, 50, 60-year history. I'm not sure if that's true, but it was it was bandied about at the time, and of course later when I inconveniently published this book called Bright Lights, Big City.
Jay McInerney is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is Bright Precious Days. I mentioned in the introduction that you wanted to look at this idea of a perfect marriage. We should note this comes from someone who's in their second marriage. So does that come with looking at it with some experience as to what this institution means?
Well, I was in my second marriage when I wrote the first of these novels, Brightness Falls. I'm I hesitate to inform you that I've actually been married 4 times now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's been 10 years since
Same number as Hemingway. So
yes.
And less than Mailer. Mailer's managed to rack up 7 marriages. And he advised me, I think, on my second divorce. You know, he said, don't let it go to court. Try and settle beforehand.
Do you understand what it is about being a writer that can put pressure on a marriage, or does it not? Do you not believe that it has anything to do with the profession?
Well, yeah, I think there are particular hazards to being married to a writer. I think writers suffer a lot more self-doubt and self-questioning than many do in their professions, and I think that, you know, it can take many years to write a novel, during which a spouse could be subjected to all of this turmoil and uncertainty, and frankly, it's not generally a terribly lucrative profession. I had the great luck to have a best-selling novel my first time out, but that posed its own perils because, the period that I've been writing the book, my second wife was virtually my only confidant, and suddenly the whole world wanted to welcome me, it was a fairly overwhelming experience for her and for me, and I think it really contributed to the demise of that marriage.
So with that experience, what were you able to look at and explore within these two characters, Richard and Quinn?
I was just fascinated. I guess I just thought, you know, what if I hadn't become a writer, if I hadn't decided to be a novelist, I probably would have been an editor. And I just sort of thought, you know, what if I managed to, you know, if I had married my college sweetheart and managed to stay married to her. Basically, Russell is living my, what Philip Roth calls my counter life. You know, Russell became my alter ego. He was the road not taken. And I guess every time that I fell out of a marriage, I became even more intrigued by the idea of monogamy and how it was possible, particularly in a city like Manhattan, where there are so many distractions and people are, you know, moving at an incredibly fast pace and perhaps distracted by bright, shiny objects, by people in the workplace. It seemed to me to be a great subject to explore.
This is a couple. They are 49 and 50 in the novel. They have 2 twins. They are really, as you just alluded to, they are struggling with this idea of monogamy and an affair, and also of being married at middle age.
Yeah, I guess when this book opens, they've been married almost 25 years. In fact, they celebrate their 25th during the course of the novel. And in some ways, it's been a very good marriage. However, it has not been without its episodes of stress and of infidelity, for that matter, on both sides. And I don't think this is terribly unrealistic on the one hand, and on the other hand, I wouldn't really have a story if the marriage were perfect. There's really no, you know, I don't think there is such a thing as a perfect marriage and or a perfect couple. And as one of them at one point points out, to call any couple the perfect couple is to really kind of jinx them, because nobody can live up to that idea.
In this novel, 9/11, and you mentioned this early on, that 9/11 plays a part, and I'm curious as to, given this, I mentioned earlier, it's been 10 years since your last novel, so you've been able to look at this and write about it, and I'm just interested of why that played a part in what you wanted to explore.
Well, you know, I was here on September 11th, 2001. I actually watched the towers fall from my apartment window. I actually saw the first plane hit, although I didn't quite understand what I was seeing at the time. It was just a flash of light against the face of the building. But like many New Yorkers, like most New Yorkers, I was traumatized. And it was probably the most traumatic event in the history of the city since the draft riots during the Civil War. I think that's the only thing that comes close. And as somebody who considered it part of his job to chronicle contemporary New York, I felt that I had to somehow deal with this event and come to terms with it in my writing. I just couldn't imagine pretending that it hadn't happened. And so eventually, it took me a few years, but eventually I wrote about the event through the basically through the lens of Russell and Kareen and their friends and how the events of 9/11 had affected them and reverberated through their lives. And I think that the events of 9/11 still echo in the current book, which begins in 2006, not that long afterwards. For those who were here, it's not something they're ever going to forget. And there are, as the days go by, as the years go by, the memory becomes less fresh and less traumatic. But you know, whenever we hear, you know, a gunshot or a truck backfiring or we see a low-flying plane, I think we tend to remember that day.
And that isn't the only, I mean, certainly the biggest event, but these characters also go through the election of the first African-American president, Barack Obama. They go through the great crash. And so you do explore this idea of these characters and how they react to real-world events.
Yeah, I mean, it was always my intention with these novels to write not just about the domestic lives of Russell and Kareem, but to write about them as citizens of the great metropolis of New York and of the Republic. And, you know, these are people who are thoughtful and engaged in their lives. The image that really started this novel, that set it in motion, was I just had this an image of Russell and Kareem and their friends sitting around in their Tribeca loft watching the election returns in November of 2008. You know, I really didn't start the book until the whole era of Obama's election and the financial crisis had kind of come into focus, you know, with the years that had passed. And on the one hand, this was an incredibly hopeful event for people like Russell and Kareen, liberal, educated New Yorkers who were horrified by, you know, the war in Iraq, not least because it seemed to be partly committed in the name of avenging September 11th. You know, it was a great moment for many, many, many people, for millions of people. But at the same time, you know, looking back from, say, 2013, that day was kind of tinged with melancholy because no one could have possibly lived up to those hopes and expectations of November 2008. And it was also a very interesting time because the world financial system was virtually melting down as we watched the election returns. And I just suddenly thought, wow, this is the next chapter for me to write about. This is the post 9/11 chapter, the 2007-2008, incredibly eventful years.
The name of the novel is Bright Precious Days. It is published by Knopf. Jay McInerney is our guest. After the success of Bright Lights, Big City, and as you mentioned, it happened to you very young. And you become really the toast of the town. You become a celebrity in New York, and a lot of people are writing about you. A lot is being said about you. And do you think that is possible today for an author to hit the way you did?
Well, you know, I think it's possible. I don't think it's happened too often.
Right.
And perhaps it was easier then because there were, I guess there were fewer distractions. We certainly didn't have reality TV show stars then. And, you know, we didn't have social media.
Right.
But in some ways, it seemed very unlikely at the time. I remember my publisher, Jason Epstein, who was the head of Random House at that time, took me out to lunch. And he said, look, you've written a very good novel here, and we're very proud to publish it. But he basically said, don't get your hopes up too high. The novel is basically dead, and people of your generation don't read anymore because of movies and TV. And he didn't want me to get my hopes up. So we were all pretty surprised when Right Lights, Big City became the phenomenon that it did. And I was surprised to find myself the toast of the town. I think it's probably harder now because, you know, I can't really think of anyone off the bat who's had that particular type of success lately.
Right.
Although, on the other hand, I do want to say that, you know, after hearing many times over that, you know, fiction, that the novel is dead, when I was a young man, people keep coming along and disproving that theorem. You know, Tom Wolfe was one of the loudest in his proclamation that the novel was dead. And then he became extra famous by, you know, publishing Bonfire of the Vanities in 1988, I guess. And every year or two, young people reinterpret the coming-of-age novel and the New York novel. I mean, most recently I can think of, you know, two authors writing first novels set in New York, Garth Riss-Kallberg and Stephanie Dandler, Sweet Bitter and City on Fire are the titles of their novels. And, you know, both published to great acclaim and justifiably so. So I'm happy to report that the novel seems to be alive and well, including the New York novel. But I don't know. I think I had a very peculiar kind of success back then in 1984.
So now the more complex question, which is, given what you went through and given that the storm that came after, would you wish that on anybody?
No, not really. You know, it was really exciting. And of course I thought of it as a dream come true for quite a while, but you know, there were the aftershocks and the hangover, I guess, eventually. And, you know, to some extent for many years afterwards, I've sort of felt like I've been trying to live down that celebrity, which was tinged with notoriety. And I think that, you know, the sort of the way in which the media created a persona for me based on Bright Lights and based on my life in New York, you know, and I admit that I was a collaborator in creating that persona. But, you know, the sort of wild party boy novelist who dates models and stays up, you know, staggers out of nightclubs near dawn. You know, that image became a bit of an albatross for me and something that I had to try to deconstruct. You know, I had to, you know, the next few times out, I had to make the case for myself as a serious literary novelist, which was my goal when I set out. In the days before Bright Lights became a bestseller.
Jay McInerney's new novel is Bright Precious Days. It is published by Knopf. Jay McInerney, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Very nice to have you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.